Campers, it's Lauren Marie Taylor, and you are listening to the Not the Final Girl podcast. Hey, everybody. We are heading across the pond for Christmas to the land of castles, towers, and snow with a chat with Charlie Steeds. He is the filmmaker renaissance man of the London-based independent genre film company, specializing in horror, of course, Dark Temple Motion Pictures. He is also joined by the talented British actor and writer David Lennick. I was honored to have the opportunity to work with both David and Charlie on the retro Christmas horror film, He Sees You When You're Sleeping. This episode is going to be a full hour special just for Christmas weekend. Let's go. What was your initiation into horror movies? Like, do you remember the very first one you watched that got you into them?
Yes. So the first horror movie I ever saw was Scream. And I saw that back in the 90s. I was very, very young when I first saw that. So I'm not going to reveal my age, but yeah, I kind of giving it away now. But I was very young. And yeah, Scream was the first horror movie that I ever saw.
Well, we have totally opposite stories of coming into horror, because David started watching horror when he was practically a baby.
Yeah.
And was asking his parents to rent him Texas Chainsaw Massacre when he was like 5 years old.
No, I was about 7 or 8. But yeah, most people had Disney at my age. Yeah, like, but hey, it turned out for the best. It turned out fine.
My introduction into horror was the complete opposite of David, because I was terrified of everything I used to watch. Even the most pathetic horror films used to terrify me until I was about 13 or 14, so I was really late to the game with horror. And I'd already decided that I really wanted to be a film director. I mean, I'm lucky that from somewhere in my young mind, I just decided I want to make films. That's what I want to do, you know. And I used to tell everyone I'm going to be a film director. I mean, I obviously loved films, but I don't know why I was so adamant that that's what I was going to do. But since probably age sort of 11 or 10, I was just set on doing that. And so I loved movies. And the great thing about horror is, because it was always so hidden from me, and my mum wasn't allowed, like, she never allowed me to watch anything scary. She was very protective of me and the things I watched on TV, like the age certificates we have here in England. 15 and 18, they were like taken extremely seriously by my mum. So she wouldn't have let me watch an 18 rated film until I was actually 18. And so suddenly, though, at age 14 or so, the whole genre of horror just opened up to me, and I'd never seen any of them, even though I was a huge film fan. I'd never seen anything, so because I was too scared. So suddenly this whole genre was there, and I just became obsessed.
Yeah, so yeah, like kind of similar to me in terms of, I always knew that I wanted to do acting just from a very young age. I can't even remember a time where I didn't want to be an actor. And obviously finding out about these horror movies so early on, I just knew that's the kind of, you know, the kind of direction that I wanted to go, even from a very young age. And luckily, my experiences weren't screened as much as yours, so I could kind of get away with watching as much as I wanted, basically.
So, Charlie, you mentioned that you knew from a very early age that you wanted to be a director. Because a lot of people at 11 years old, you know, you want to be a superhero or something. But to say I want to be a director, there must have been some rock of a movie or a director that had such an impact on you.
Yeah, there was. It was Tim Burton. And I used to love The Nightmare Before Christmas. Even though he didn't direct it, you can see Tim Burton's style all the way through it. And then I'd watch Sleepy Hollow or Edward Scissorhands and films like that. And I was kind of realizing for the first time, well, hang on a minute, Batman Returns looks just like Nightmare Before Christmas. You know, what is that? And I see the same names popping up. Danny Elfman with the music. You know, they look the same. They sound the same. I'm seeing production designers are the same. And that's when I realized really what a director does, and that this is telling stories in this person's style. And I could see, I mean, because Tim Burton's style is so clear, you know, so obvious to everyone who sees a Tim Burton film that it's Tim Burton, that's why for the first time it was a revelation. Ah, this is what a director does. And because I, even though I wasn't a huge horror fan as a child, my reputation at school was always I was a storyteller, and you know, when the teacher would set work for me and all the other kids to do, everyone who was sat on my table was there because they knew we weren't going to do the actual work. I was going to tell them some sort of scary story. So that's what I spent most of my childhood doing, you know, sitting under the dining room table at my babysitter's house with all the other kids under the table, telling them scary horror stories. So I always was interested in telling stories to people. And then when you see people like Tim Burton directing, I just realized I want to do it for film.
How do you approach creating that kind of suspense and fear when telling the story? And how does that translate into filmmaking?
Well, I think for me, I actually have like kind of a difficult time in a way with horror, because I know David's the same. Like, we don't really find anything scary.
Mm.
And that's quite tricky, because when you're speaking to other people who've watched, oh, you've got to go and see this new horror film, you've got to go and see that new horror film, they're saying, oh, it's so scary. But to us, you know, I have no sense of what is and isn't scary.
Yeah, yeah, I feel the same. And it's like you can understand how someone's finding it scary, but you're not finding it yourself. But you can appreciate, you know, good scares and things like that. But we don't have the same kind of, you know, feel to it, I suppose.
Yeah, so for me, when I'm making a horror film, when it comes to actually crafting jump scares or scary things, I find it kind of difficult, to be honest, which is not really very good for a horror filmmaker. But, you know, some feedback I've had from my distributors when they take my films to market is they'll say, you know, the buyers wanted it to be more scary or there to be more terror. But for me, I think what I go to in a horror movie is I enjoy, my number one thing is I love carnage and gore. So I'm a big fan of carnage, and that's what I'm trying to do in my horror films, is create as much carnage as possible. In it, like, in a way, I love action movies and I love action in horror films, you know, and if I can have just any sort of carnage happening. I mean, if I had the budgets, I'd be making horror films where things blow up and cars somersault, you know, if the story provides for it. So I like, and I guess that's what I find not scary necessarily, but that's what makes my heart pound when I'm watching a horror film. When I'm watching something like, just one that comes to mind is the remake of The Hills Have Eyes, which is a film I really love. Yes. It's like just the whole last half an hour of the film is heart pounding, adrenaline, gore, pickaxes going through heads. And that's for me what I love about horror, you know, rather than scares. And then I'd say the other thing is, what got me hooked on horror when I finally came around to it was Stephen King, all adaptations of Stephen King stories. And his stories are always character first, and it's usually like a suburban everyman or a suburban family. And it doesn't come in with nasty, horrible, scary stuff. There's always a heart to Stephen King. You know, if you think of like It, which is probably the scariest Stephen King, you know, at the heart of it is a group of kids who are all best friends and just reminds you of an idyllic summer holiday as a child. And so when I'm writing my films, you know, I try and always make sure that that is what I prioritize over scares, because it'd be easy to have, you know, like a scary dead person's face jump out. But then I always have to try and stay true to the characters and what is what's affecting their lives. So often I can't just throw in a whole load of ghosts, because I'm always drawn to the drama tends to take over the horror for me.
Yeah, The Shining is one of my favorite adaptations, and Stanley Kubrick really utilized music to give you that sense of, you know, foreboding and creepiness and whatnot. Do you also do that in your films?
Yeah, I mean, I'm actually really, really hands-on with the music when the composers are doing the scores for my movies. Like, I'm also a huge music fan outside of films anyway. Like, if I had another passion other than film, it would be music. And so when it comes to the scores for my films, I mean, I know other filmmakers who, you know, at an independent film level where you can't always afford and a composer, you know, they'll just use stock music, or, you know, or I'll watch other indie films and the music just kind of sounds like a bit sort of ambient. It's sort of just droning on. But if you listen to my movie soundtracks, they never sound like that. They're always pretty, you know, full on. And it's because I will like walk my composers through. Sometimes I will walk my composers through every single step of like, this is what this moment has to sound like. This is what that moment has to sound like, with a lot of specific
examples. Not saying that you're a nightmare director or anything.
Yeah. But I'd say music, you know, it is so important to the movie. So, yeah, when it comes to trying to create your atmosphere and trying to create the scares, I mean, the music goes a really long way. And especially for what I was saying about like action sequences in horror, you know, really trying to get the music to be like heart pounding, fast paced music. That's hard to come by, composers who can actually pull that off at an independent film level. But, you know, right from my first feature films, I've always managed to find talented people who can really bring the music, you know.
I think you've always had a composer, haven't you, from everything?
Oh, yeah. I never would dream of doing a film with stock music. To me, that's completely alien. But I know people who do it.
You know, you talked about how atmosphere is created with music. I watched An English Haunting and Death Ranch back to back. Two completely different movies, by the way. I was struck by the atmosphere that you created, very different, like I said, for both films. What role does location play in enhancing the horror elements in your movies?
Well, it's a good observation because location, for me, is really what guides me from project to project. It's actually the most absolutely important part because at the end of the day, it tends to be the most expensive element of any of the films I make is the location, you know, where are we going to do it? So English Haunting and Death Ranch were actually both shot back to back, within the space of about 6 months. But, you know, and I loved jumping from something, you know, being in the freezing cold winter in Britain, where every morning we woke up, it was foggy and freezing cold.
Yeah, I mean, that movie is like, it's really grey and drab and dark and atmospheric. And it literally was like that. Filming it.
You just live that, you know.
Yeah, which was amazing. It definitely helped getting into character.
And I mean, so with an English Haunting, I was doing some completely other videography work years before I made the film, and the work led me to this house, which is the mansion from An English Haunting, and it's a privately owned estate, which is really unusual for such a gorgeous, huge estate to be privately owned, but it's been in this particular family for over 1,000 years. Usually these places would be taken away by the National Trust or places like that who would preserve it and make it open to the public. But
so
this
it's really unusual that the family was still living in there as well. Like,
oh yeah, they lived there.
I mean, they had their bedrooms in a certain wing, and there was, you know, a whole section of the house that was not used. And, you know, we kind of were at play there, really, weren't we?
Yeah,
kind of had so much of the house to ourselves. Well, they, you know, had their own like little wing that we couldn't use, but the rest of the house was basically ours. It was amazing.
Did you stay there while you were filming?
No, we stayed about 10 minutes away, which, you know, it was actually quite nice. Like, I don't know if we'd actually wanted to stay there the night. I believe it actually was haunted.
We might have gone kind of mad if we'd actually been having to stay in the place the entire time.
Because
it was, the shoot lasted about 18 days, I think.
Oh, no, it was more than that. Because that was just with Tessa for the 18 days. And then I had lots of stuff just by myself going down the halls for about a week. I feel like an extra week of just going down the hallways and just doing lots of my own stuff.
But yeah, I mean, we were working around this small family who lives in there. But, you know, while we were performing scenes, we had like their young daughters who must have been, I don't know, about 8 or 10.
Yeah.
Sort of sitting across the hall from us, watching us filming these scenes. And then as it got closer to Christmas, the Christmas tree went up in the corner. We had to make sure we'd done all of our shots in that room. But I'd come across this location on a completely separate job. And as soon as I saw it and I learnt of this situation that it was privately owned, I just thought, oh my God, like, I need to make a haunted house film here. I was looking around and I was like, a multi-million dollar budget from Warner Brothers or something could not buy you this house. it just couldn't. And no other film has ever been made in the house. So it was just
so
like...
So lucky. So lucky.
And everywhere you put the camera... I mean, I'll be honest, there's. It sounds lazy, but there is basically no set dressing in the entire film.
I mean, there was a bit... But yeah, I mean... No. There's a lot that you didn't need to do.
Everything is really as we found it, you know. And I was... So I wrote the entire script around the location. I spoke to the owners. We negotiated a fee. I decided it was doable. And then I wrote the script around what we had available. And so that's how the project came to be. And then Death Ranch was completely the same. A good filmmaker friend of mine, Aaron Mertes, who makes lots of good indie films. I'd seen one of his films, and I'd seen within the film this barn on his land in Nashville, Tennessee. And it was similar sort of a location to another script idea I'd had a while ago. And I thought if I could adapt it to be here, then this location would be amazing. So the locations are absolutely key to each film. And in fact, so much they dictate really where I'm going next.
You shot a film in Norway, am I correct?
Correct.
Yes, yeah.
How did you wind up in Norway of all places?
Well, at the beginning, when I was making my sort of first three or four horror films, they all had to be like very small and contained, but you know, for budget limitations. And I had the idea to set a film entirely in a log cabin. So we built the interior of a log cabin. This is for my film Winter Skin, and David is the lead character in that one. And so we built the interior of the log cabin. It's a two-floor cabin, which, you know, when you watch the film, you cannot tell that it's not an existing cabin, but it was actually completely built just in the back garden for the film. And then we knew we would need to go and get the exteriors in a place where there's actually snow. So we actually went to Finland. And
Lapland, in Finnish Lapland.
Yeah, and I was dreading, you know, how are we going to get the camera out in the snow and have the actors out in the snow? And not to mention there was a scene with a character tied naked to a tree.
Not me, thankfully.
No.
And draw the line somewhere.
But there was a scene where David had to trudge through the snow in the nighttime. So it was like, how do we light, you know, the woods of Finland in the pitch black, and how cold is it going to be? And the answer was extremely cold, and the snow came above David's waist, so he looked like he was swimming through the snow.
It was close to my chest, but because it was so difficult trudging through it, I was actually sweating. Like I wasn't even cold. It was so difficult, and you know, like it took a lot of strength to get through that snow. So I wasn't even cold at that point.
But to my surprise, I loved, and I think you loved, filming in the snow.
Yeah, loved it.
Absolutely loved it. And we're really lucky that from London, we can fly over to, you know, places like Norway and Finland for so cheap. You know, it's like £25 would be a flight over there if you're clever and you book a cheap flight. So you can get there for very little money, and the snow just looks amazing.
And I think it's because obviously we did filming for Winter Skin several years ago when the opportunity and the budget came through for the new film Freeze. You felt confident that you could go to Norway and film it in all the snow, which is then what we did.
Absolutely. And what led us to Norway was there's a location that I've always wanted to visit, and that's because I'm not a huge Star Wars geek, but in The Empire Strikes Back, there's a snow planet called Planet Hoth, and it's where all the snow scenes in Star Wars take place, with all the big, cool. You know, all the big, whatever, that Star Wars fans going to hate us.
Yeah, but both me and Charlie are huge film fans, but not Star Wars fans, so it's kind of lost on us a little bit. Like, I don't really know.
But the exact location of where they filmed all that stuff for Star Wars, I could see on the map in Norway, and it's a place that's not even accessible by roads. you have to, that all there is one train that goes into the one station there, and then it's just snow. And it's like a complete winter wonderland. So I decided a long time ago, I really want to make a film in this exact spot where they filmed Star Wars. So when the opportunity to make Freeze came along, the job outline was basically, the company said to me, we just want a film with snow in it. And that was the only requirement. And so I devised this whole horror film with all these fish creatures and this ship that gets ice locked. And I decided we'd go and film it in Norway. But then when me and David went to the exact spot to scout it out,
I think it's called Finse, isn't it?
Finse.
Yeah.
It was so treacherous. You know, it was so cold, so sort of blizzardy and foggy.
It was pretty unbelievable. I was like, we can't film here. It's not possible.
David would take a step and then scream at the top of his voice as he fell, basically all the way to his chin.
I thought I was a goner. I thought I was like, in that snow, you'd never find me. I was gone forever.
In snow that was so deep.
Sadly not.
We both have a few photos on our phones of each other kind of on the floor rolling around in the snow where we've tripped and the others quickly got their phone out to try and snap a video quickly while we're rolling around like an idiot on the floor.
That was why it's good that we did a recce there beforehand, because had we not done that and, you know, just brought the entire cast and crew out there, we would have, you know, it would have been a lot more of a problem.
Yeah, I was going to ask you about that. How do you get the crew and the cast and all the equipment that you need into a place that's so desolate?
Well, what we did was, I mean, luckily this place is reachable by train. So we flew into, you know, Oslo, which is a major city. And then you can just get the train up towards...
beautiful.
Yeah, stunning scenery. And just the further north you go, the more it turns into like huge, like snowy mountains.
It was amazing.
And then everyone's nice and cozy in a little cabin, which is, you know, on the train line. And then in the mornings, everyone would have to get on the train. Everyone's got all the props and all the equipment, and it's a handful. You know, it's absolutely everyone's got every hand full with as much as they possibly can have, and anything we can't carry just has to get left behind.
It wasn't glamorous.
Not glamorous. And the way we found where we actually shot Freeze was, because we didn't want to shoot in Finse exactly, because it was too horrible, as we got the train, you know, a little bit further away, about 10 minutes out, we passed by this amazing looking mountain in the distance, and the train stopped, and I just wrote down the name of the station, and I said, this is where we're going to come with everyone. We're going to walk to this mountain tomorrow. But then when we did show up with all the kit, the mountain kind of looked like it was maybe a 20-minute walk, but we walked for 20 minutes and then an hour, and then you feel like you're nearly there, but you go over the hill and it's even further.
So basically, in the end, we got one of those skidoos. Is that what they're called? Is it a skidoo?
I think so, yeah.
I think it is, where we basically had to hire someone to drive us all on the back of like this massive like snow trailer onto the top of the mountain.
After the first day, we paid for the skidoo, but on the first day, we had to walk. So after 2 hours of trekking up a mountain, we were all sweating, and that's where we filmed it. And then still then, I was flying my drone toward the mountain. I flew it 500 meters directly at the mountain, and it still was nowhere near. So I have no idea how far away the mountain was, but
that's like the ritual or something.
Yeah.
But like, oh my god, I have to say, that was like as much fun as that film was, and I absolutely loved every second of it. That film was the toughest film I've ever like taken part in ever. I've never noticed cold quite like that before. Like I've never known anything like that. I think it was -22 and wind chill. And I can tell you, in 19th century costumes on top of a mountain at -22, it was beyond anything I could ever have imagined. And it was tough, but I think it turned out quite well, which is the main thing.
People in reviews of this film, Freeze, I've seen them say, you know, the film was good in parts, but there's a really unbelievable thing, which is that, you know, all these people go out onto the snow, you know, without proper winter clothing and proper winter protection. And, you know, within the film, they have to flee the ship in an instant because fish creatures are attacking. And, You know, I say to those people, the crew and the cast were up there wearing just that. So that's, you know, we were doing it for real, okay. And we were surviving.
Enough of the we. The actors, including myself, did not have any warm clothing, but the director was nice and toasty. Oh, that's all I'm saying.
Oh yeah, I was significantly more dressed.
So
up.
That there was no we in this team.
No, but what had actually happened was. Winter coats were supposed to come, but they were period costume for everyone, and half of them showed up in time for the shoot and the other half didn't, so I made an executive decision to just have people not in the winter coats. David was one of those people.
Oh yeah, I unfortunately fell into that category. Hey, I'm always taking one for the team, but in between takes we did have like nice big jackets on, but you know, those takes were few and far between. So
you've done a lot of medieval horror. Do you have a favorite location that you think about and you go, I'd like to revisit that with a different story?
Well, I always love the snow, and I think I'm going to be going back to the snow very soon. And
with coats
this time, yeah. And I love the house from An English Haunting that we spoke about earlier is really one of my favourite locations. And I guess a bit nearer the time, we were very keen to do a sequel and stuff. But, you know, the film came out right in the middle of the COVID pandemic. So nobody was really jumping on me for a sequel right there. But whereas at the time we sold it, people were latching onto it right away because, you know, haunted house films in this sort of setting, you know, they always go down a treat. But yeah, apart from those two, there's not any. I mean, I'm really into keeping going to new places, new locations. And, you know, you said about the medieval films that I did, they were actually two films that got shot back to back because I knew I was going to be making this medieval film about the Tower of London. And so the film's called The Haunting of the Tower of London. And it's a true story, or it's based on a true story that was, this was given to me as a job. And I said, okay, I'll write a script around this Tower of London. And then right at the last minute, they just threw at me, okay, and we'll make a werewolf film as well. So I was sort of like, oh, okay. So I ended up doing two films back to back, shooting for 6 weeks. And we were sort of able to use the same resources on both films. And we used two castles in Wales for the film. One is called Raglan Castle, which is like a huge ruin. And the other is a really sort of looks like a fairy tale castle, really beautiful inside. And that's called Castle Coch. And so we used both castles, but I loved shooting in the castles. They were very expensive locations, probably the most expensive locations I've ever filmed at, you know, per hour. And that made the pressure extremely intense because I kept saying to the cast, you know, every time they were talking, you know, I was saying 1 minute here is costing us, you know, whatever it was costing us, you know, £5 a minute or something like that. You know, if you take a 4 minute break, you know, you've cost us this much, you cost us that much. And obviously I wouldn't allow a lunch break because, you know, if you break 20 minutes, even 20 minutes for lunch, you know, you're talking hundreds of pounds have been spent on a lunch break. So it was really high intensity. So I like the look of those locations, but I definitely don't miss them.
When you look at these period pieces, right? And I've watched a lot of your trailers and they're really quite frightening, actually. And you talked about carnage. So how do you balance that gore with practical effects and with also being able to create psychological horror?
Yeah, well, I think each project kind of calls for, you know, its own certain style. So something like An English Haunting, I realized straight away that it was going to be quite a subtle sort of a horror film and it wasn't going to have the need for gore.
Yeah, it's very minimal gore, that one.
So that was very minimal. But at the same time, as I say, I love carnage. So as I got towards the climax of the movie, I'm trying to find a way
to incorporate it.
I can incorporate something nasty. And I came up with the idea that, you know, even though it's a just a typical ghost story, I came up with the idea that, you know, when the sort of killer is revealed at the end, you know, they should have a weapon. Well, I'll give them a sledgehammer, you know, so then they can really bash the hell out of some people. So, you know, you're in the final 10 minutes, even though it's a ghost story, you're suddenly seeing people get sledgehammered, but it fits in with the story and that character would behave in that way. But then when it comes to something like The Haunting of the Tower of London, I decided I was going to do this sort of over-the-top, gothic-style, sort of Roger Corman-influenced. And so when you're doing stuff like that, you can just go crazy, and you can have as... The idea with that film was to have as many ghosts and as many nasty bits as I could possibly fit into it. And same goes for something like Death Ranch, you know, so splattery and nasty.
I thought that was one of your more subtle films, actually.
Oh, what? But, you know, I was saying earlier about building sets for films, and the only reason for my film Winter Skin, we built the interior of a cabin instead of just going to Finland and shooting the film inside the cabin, was because I knew there was going to be so much blood inside the cabin that there was no way we could do it, you know, in an actual person's cabin. And people don't realize when they watch these films, you know, like the amount of blood that gets used. But, you know, in the end of Winter Skin, there's this huge sort of Western style shootout where people are getting shot in the head and shot in the face. And
it's a pretty violent movie, actually.
Blood spraying everywhere. That comes from my love of Westerns and like Italian Westerns. But every time one of those, you know, bullet hits are done, it's probably like, you know, at least a pint of fake blood. And so we're doing about 5 to 10 blood hits per death, you know, and there's like 4 or 5 people dying on screen all in. I mean, the floor,
it was
we were
soaked with blood.
We were in a pool of water. There were you know, fake blood. There was like 2 inches thick of fake blood on the floor. You know, by the time we were done, all the floorboards were warped and bent, the whole thing was leaning the wrong way. We would have destroyed an entire house if we'd actually done it.
And I just remember on that film, the term buckets of blood, like that actually were buckets of blood. Like, there were many scenes where, you know, there's lots of blood that has to be sprayed into actors' faces, myself included. And Charlie would just be like, right, get the bucket, and literally chuck buckets of blood over the actors.
I would be there with an actual bucket of blood.
And I think that's what you love the most, isn't it? Is, you know, getting your actors all like in distress and covered in blood. I think you actually really enjoy that.
When people ask me about, you know, especially actors, when they ask me about, do I love the blood and do I love the gore?
Which never affects you.
To me, in my mind, I'm like, yeah, I do like the blood, but, you know, having the blood out on set, I don't particularly think I love it. You know, it's gets all sticky. I get sticky. But then having said that, when the blood comes out, when I'm making a film, it's the only time I really just go into some sort of weird, like, filmmaker zone. It's the only time I'm fully on top form, full adrenaline, full energy. It's only when the blood comes out that I start to really have like the best time ever.
And like, as uncomfortable as it is, and as sticky as it is, and as cold as it is, and obviously you're spending hours and hours like just covered in blood so often, like, I kind of love it as well. I just really enjoy
it. There's something exciting.
Yeah, there is. As you very well know, Lauren. So
Yeah.
You know what? I gotta tell you, we've been chatting for a while, and I'm just sitting here rolling on the floor practically, because here you're talking about blood and gore and buckets of and carnage, but it sounds so polite because of your accent.
Yeah, well, it's always got to be polite.
Hey, David, so I have to ask you, for the role of Blake, I'm always going back to An English Haunting, maybe because I just want to visit castles. Did you do any kind of research into haunted houses or the paranormal, or watch any films for inspiration for your role?
Yeah, so that was kind of easy for me because I'm interested in all that kind of stuff anyway. So I'm really interested in the paranormal. I'm really interested in anything horror related. I love a period drama. So I've always been like preparing for something like that. I love that kind of thing. So I was already kind of immersed in that kind of world already. So when Charlie amazingly wrote that role for me, it wasn't too difficult to kind of, you know, have a think and have a look at various different things that I already loved. And so I could kind of, you know, already do my research from there on. So,
well, yeah. We both grew up in the countryside, over in sort of like the sort of southwest, I guess it is, mm-hmm. where, you know, we're not so far from like Stonehenge, and we grew up, you know, near those sorts of places.
Yeah.
So where we come from, there's really legitimately old scary places everywhere, you know, and you know, when we're visiting America making films, you go into a place and they'll say, oh, this is, you know, this is apparently a haunted place, and the place looks like it was built last year. And me and David kind of just roll our eyes, you know, there's nothing scary about it. But, you know, where we come from, you go into a pub and they'll say, oh, this is a haunted pub, haunted by three ghosts, and they tell you the story, and it looks like a pub from a horror film.
Yeah.
And so it's just sort of all around us, you know. But,
and obviously the house in An English Haunting was just so amazing and was hundreds and hundreds and hundreds of years old. And there was lots of like apparent ghost stories already about the house. We spent a lot of time there, and there was definitely, you know, a presence there, a feeling. So a lot of those scenes in that film, you know, weren't too hard to film because, you know, it looked scary on film, and you know, it kind of was scary in that house. We were filming late into the night. There was lots of times where, you know, there was lots of times I was spending a lot of time on my own in the house, like, because it was just so big. So, you know, you always felt like there was some sort of presence there, I think. But I love it at the same time. It's really creepy, but I'm also kind of obsessed with it as well.
And David's a big practical joker, so yeah. If you didn't think the house was haunted, David was there hiding in the closet of the other actors' dressing rooms.
I freely admit that I would do that a lot.
He was there. His co-star Tessa, to this day, still doesn't know some of the shenanigans that David was getting up to. And at one point, I mean, David, maybe you should tell the story, but at one point, you were like, what are you doing, scratching on the door? Or?
No, I can vaguely remember, because there were so many different rooms, and like you would leave one room and you'd end up in another room, and you could almost do a complete circle of it, and like without kind of even going into the hallway, you could just go in all these different rooms. And I just remember like saying Tess's name in a ghostly way in one room.
And then
I was able to creep into a different room, and then she'd go into that room, and then I'd already be in the hallway because I managed to go round the corner or something. So she was really believing that there was a ghost calling her name.
So he's on one side of the door going, Tessa. And Tessa's there going, who's there? Who's there? And then coming into an empty room because he snuck out of one of the many doors.
And then I would end up in the hallway and I'd be like, Tessa, what's going on? Are you okay? Pretty sure I did tell her in the end though, because like that just sounds like I was almost gaslighting.
She's coming off set going to me, there's a feeling in this house. You know, there's something there.
I did it just enough to make people think that there was something, but then, you know, I'm pretty sure I did reveal it in the end. I wouldn't have let her, you know, continue thinking that there was a ghost. But I think in general that there was definitely something going on in that house for sure.
Now, when we were filming He Sees You When You're Sleeping, the owners of the house swore up and down that there were a couple of presences in the house. Did you get that vibe at all?
So I didn't get any vibes from that house.
No, this is what I mean about the American thing. That house was lovely and cute.
It was a really nice house.
Two little dogs running around and all the children. It's the least scary house I've ever been in.
But then obviously because we filmed in two different houses, so that the other house felt like there was kind of more of a presence.
Yeah, the main house where we did a majority of the shoot, that was a little bit more creepy.
Yeah, but again, I mean the basement, that I felt like there was a presence in the basement, but yeah, I don't really know.
We have to talk about our experience working together on He Sees You When You're Sleeping. First of all, you're British, you came all the way over to New York to shoot it. What inspired you to create a horror movie set during Christmas time in America?
Yeah, so I mean that script for me was, you know, a dream come true. I've been an actor for many years.
Yeah.
And I've always written. I've been writing since I was so young, but only professionally the last couple of years. And, you know, to actually get this film up on its feet was just such a dream for me. But I'm just a huge horror fan anyway, but I love Christmas horror. Like, one of my favourite horror movies of all time is the original Black Christmas. I absolutely love it. I love Christmas-themed horror movies. So when I was writing, the script, it just made so much sense to me that I wanted to write it during Christmas time. And I love slasher movies, and I also love 1980s soap operas. So I kind of wanted to, I know, the two very different things, but I kind of wanted to blend the two. So when I was writing He Sees You When You're Sleeping, I wanted to kind of, you know, incorporate all those Christmas slashes and, you know, things that I wanted to see in a Christmas slasher that I hadn't necessarily seen. And also incorporate, you know, the outrageousness of an 80s soap. So I had so much fun writing that film. And it just from writing it, it just made so much sense that it would be in America. I kind of only visualized seeing it in America. I don't know. I just don't think it would have worked as well over here in England. It was a very American script for me, but so I only ever saw it being, you know, filmed there. Yeah.
Well, since we're going there without giving too much away, because we want people to see it when it comes out, can you give our listeners just a little nibble of the plot?
Absolutely. Yeah, of course. So it's actually set in the 80s. Surprise, surprise. And so obviously I'm in it as well. I had the privilege of being in it and writing it. And my character experiences something really horrific when I'm a very young boy. I witness my parents get brutally murdered by a serial killer dressed in a Santa costume. And then it's 20 years later and my character is kind of recovering from, you know, the past trauma. And it's the first time in 20 years that he's returning to the house where it happened. And he's got, you know, his kind of wretched family that still live there and a whole assortment of like really fun, quirky, interesting characters. And the murders start up again with a killer Santa. And you kind of, you know, you don't know who the killer is. You don't know kind of who's behind it all. It's a lot of fun. There's a lot of comedy in there, a lot of horror in there. And a really fun script. And I think we all had a fun time as well.
Yes, we did. Was it when you were writing it, of course, because you had these different influences in your brain, yeah. Was it difficult or strange to balance the horror elements with the cheery holiday spirit, you know, that dysfunctional family of 80s television? Was that hard to kind of blend those together?
Yeah, I mean, I think like with all the scripts that I've written, I feel like this was absolutely by far the easiest script I've ever written. I just felt like it was just flowing out. And because I have so much passion for, you know, all the influences that were included in the script, it literally would just, you know, like I was like bursting with ideas. So it really felt like it flowed very well. And I knew exactly kind of the kind of feel and atmosphere I wanted the film to have. You know, it's got a little bit of Scream in there. It's got some Black Christmas in there. It's got, when the horror is horror, it's really strong horror. But then, you know, you've got the fun campiness of like, you know, 80s soaps and, you know, all these characters like fighting and dysfunctional families and all that kind of thing, which is, so, you know, there's a lot of silly fun stuff in there, as you know, having, you know, done some 80s soaps yourself. So you kind of, you know, exactly how that kind of dynamic works. And it was quite easy for me to add in the horror to that. So it felt quite not easy, but you know, it was flowing.
Yeah, the characters are definitely a lot of fun in that family.
Yeah.
Oh my god. And the actors were great.
Oh, they were fantastic.
Yeah, we were really lucky.
We were so lucky. So lucky with the cast. We couldn't have asked for a better cast, to be honest. It was amazing.
I mean, I know how I was cast in the role of Sue Ellen, but how did you find the other actors? Did you do Zoom auditions or did you see work of theirs and then just reach out to them?
Yeah, so we put out a casting through Backstage and then we basically had just over Zoom, that's how we met everyone. So we obviously couldn't do in-person auditions, but I'd known from shooting two other films in America, Death Ranch and my killer scarecrow film that's yet to be released, Night Harvest. After those two films, you know, I'd done casting through Zoom, and to be honest, it kind of is fine. It, like, you know, you have these interviews with people over the over the internet, and then when I met them, they were great, and so it worked out just as well as it would if I'd met them in person.
And then, obviously, with Caroline, we went through our agent, I think.
So. Yeah, we knew that for the character Aunt Marion, we knew it was a place to try and bring in, a sort of bigger horror name. And we both loved the idea of having Caroline Williams from Texas Chainsaw Massacre 2 in that role. And so, you know, we just pursued her. Obviously, she didn't apply through backstage. But, you know, the same way, you know, then David was saying, you know, oh, Sue Ellen, you know, what about Laura Marie Taylor? And, you know, just directly contacted you guys because we knew that, you know, these roles would be great with you guys.
Yeah,
you know?
And obviously with both you and Caroline, we saw you in the characters from the get-go. You know, we were hoping that, you know, you would take the roles, and luckily you did. And it worked out really fantastic. But I mean, you both played it so beautifully. It was just a joy to, you know, kind of be on set and get to watch that as well.
Was it hard for you to act in something that you wrote and felt so close to?
Yeah, no, that's a really good question, because usually I'm just, you know, I'm just the actor in these films. So, you know, to get to do both, it really was a whole different experience for me. I guess I really had to, in terms of the acting, I really had to kind of separate myself from the writing as a writer and as an actor. I kind of had to, you know, put two different hats on. And, you know, when I wasn't in the scene, my writing hat would come on. And I guess I would be, you know, a little bit of a perfectionist, but I've worked with Charlie a lot of the time, like so often. So, you know, I trust him completely. And we had a lot of basically the same vision. So I trusted him, you know, 100%.
Did you ever butt heads at all? Like, you know, well, I wrote it with this intention, and Charlie would say to you, well, but I see it going this way. Did that ever happen between the two of you during filming?
I mean, I don't think it did.
There was one time, but it's funny. There was one time where I really wanted to use in the film real weapons, because sometimes I use foam weapons, like, you know, when I've done these medieval horror films, the swords, I'm sorry, they just absolutely have to be foam. I'm not having somebody get their head cut off on my set with a real sword. So they have to, if it's being swung around, it has to be foam. But on this film, I felt like we weren't going to be doing anything too crazy. So I was like, we absolutely need a real axe and pickaxe. A real pickaxe, because yep. I want the...
as you probably know better than anybody, no spoilers.
Not to spoil anything, but Laura knows all about the pickaxe. And I wanted them to be real weapons because they just look so much better when they're real and rusty. And anyway, when we were filming one day, we had a real axe, but we had not managed to find a pickaxe. And so I was saying to David, right, we're going to do this. We've got the axe. Look at the axe. Look how perfect it is. It's real. It's rusty. And David's going to me, no, that character kills people with a pickaxe. I'm going, I know in the script he kills with a pickaxe, but we don't have a pickaxe. We have an axe, and look how good it is, and this is what we're going to use. And he's going, no, it's got to be a pickaxe, got to be a pickaxe. And so this was on the shoot day. And luckily, in the small little town we were filming, we'd made friends with basically... All of the locals. And so I messaged the lady who owned the local bar and restaurant and said, I need a pickaxe, you know. And 10 minutes later, this is how amazing this little...
They were amazing.
This little New York town where 10 minutes later, a guy pulls up in a pickup truck, comes out, knocks on the door and just says, like, somebody wanted a pickaxe. And there was a perfect pickaxe.
Almost didn't have time to blink. It was just like, I wanted a pickaxe, the pickaxe arrives.
And also we almost ran out of time at the very end of the film. And I said, you know, that's it. You know, time's up. It's 3 a.m. and we need to clear out of the location. And
oh, my God, yeah, I remember that very well.
Because for me, this is like feature film number 15 or 16. And, you know, if you get into this situation, you just have to suck it up, sort it out later. You know, the location agreement says you end at 3, so you end at 3. But David, it being his script and his baby, was determined that we weren't going to finish at
there was,
three.
There was no way.
So he went to basically beg, borrow and steal from the location owner to make sure that we got the extra time we needed, which we did. So
I mean, literally, it was, you know, we'd basically done the majority of the movie. This was like a really important climactic scene. The location owner, you know, was pretty strict on timings. And, you know, it got to 3 a.m. We'd been filming, obviously, for hours and hours. But, you know, we still, you know, had a fair amount to shoot, like a couple of hours, you know, just to get this, like, final part done of the night. And, you know, we were leaving location the next morning. So, you know, it was now or never. And, you know, people were packing up and I just sat there, you know, in costume watching the film, just like, and I was thinking, there's no way we are stopping now, that this is literally not happening. And I was like, right, guys, stop packing up because I'm going to make sure we get the extra time that we need. Hoping that we would. I wasn't sure. But
which was pretty handy, to be honest.
Yeah, I can't imagine had we not, you know, got that final part in. And when, you know, everyone does get to see the film, like, yeah, it's pretty integral. So there was no way I was going to allow that to kind of escape us. So yeah, I guess I was pretty adamant on some things. I suppose I've completely forgotten all these things. In terms of like vision itself and things like that, we were pretty much on par, weren't we?
Yeah, well, when I read the script for the first time, you know, I really liked it. And I don't ever take, you know, usually writing is my biggest passion. Mm. And usually I write my own scripts. And my rule is, if a script comes to me and I read it, if I'm going to do it, then I'm going to do it how the writer wants it to be done. I don't want to come in and go, you know, it's a really good script, but, you know, 10% of it needs a bit of my own director flair. No, I want it to be 100% what the writer has given me.
And you were really, really respectful of that.
And
for sure,
if I'm not 100% in, then I'm not going to do it. But when I read this script, I got it. I loved it. And I, you know, what I found unique about it was that it was a horror slasher film that was also like a TV soap opera that was camp as hell, you know, like so fun and silly and campy, but then also had sort of this like nasty killer Santa horror element.
And like nasty characters as well. Everyone's nasty, aren't they?
Yeah. And it just worked. And I knew I'd have a really good time directing it. And I did, you know, when it came to doing these scenes where these characters are bitching and killing each other and shooting insults, backstabbing each other. It was just so fun.
It's in post-production right now. When do you think it'll be released?
Well, the delivery deadline is February. So that's when the distributor is going to have it in their hands. And usually for me, it's like sort of 5 to 6 months later that it usually finally appears. But it kind of varies. I mean, we're aware that it's kind of going to be kind of aiming for a release by the sounds of that, kind of right in the middle of summer. And we're thinking, well, are they going to release it in summer or will they try and wait a bit more till winter? We really don't know. So, but the edit has actually been completed and I've seen a full assembly cut, and now it just needs sound design and grading, which will all be done through January, and then February the 1st is the deadline.
And so I've not seen any of the edit yet. So I've seen like this tiny little I know it's kind of crazy that I haven't, but you know, I'll see like a more full cut before, you know, it gets released anywhere or before anyone else gets to see it, so I can give my you know final nod of approval. But I kind of want to see it in a more in like a, you know, a full state rather than like bits and pieces. And you know, I trust Charlie, so
yeah, it's called the director's cut, not the writer's cut.
Well, we'll see.
Well, this will all be up on your website, right, when it's being released, or links to wherever it might be.
It's www.darktemple.co.uk. And then, of course, on all of our Twitter and Instagram, I mean, we'll be posting it for weeks and months until everyone's seen it.
I mean, people are going to be sick of seeing me post about it. So, yeah, it'll be pretty nonstop.
Do you have any projects that you're working on right now that you're excited about?
I have films that are going to be going into production early next year. And to be honest, the turnaround can be so quick that, you know, at the moment, I can't say for sure exactly. I don't know for sure exactly which films are going to be shot. But, you know, come March and April, I'll be shooting probably two new features. And they are yet undecided exactly what they're going to be. But I have so many sort of pitches and scripts sort of rolling around. And it's just up to the producers to decide which one gets made. But we're almost at a point where we're nailing down exactly what to make next. But I also have just been finishing up post on two films. One is my Killer Scarecrow film, Night Harvest, which I shot in Tennessee. And that is just been completely finished. I've not actually sat and watched it for the first time yet, you know, with everything, with the music and the color grade. So this week I'll be watching that for the first time. And I have another one, which is a werewolf film. It'll be my third werewolf film, but it's a very different take on werewolves, and it's set in modern day London, and it's very sort of drama heavy. And I usually don't set anything in modern times, but this one is about a lot of modern issues, so it's a completely different sort of a thing for me. And that one's called Lord of Wolves, and I've just finished the cut of that, and it's just going in to have sound and grading done. So yeah,
what are you doing right now, David?
I've written something that I was commissioned to do, so that's still in the process, so nice. I'm working on that, so yeah. Fingers crossed all goes well with that. Obviously, again, back on the old audition circuit as an actor, you very much know how that is. But there's a few projects potentially that are in the murmurings at the moment. And I have a film that will be another film that I'm really excited to come out next year, called Arctic's Edge. It's a thriller movie. So it's my first non-horror movie that I've actually been in. So I'm really looking forward to seeing that one. So that'll be out probably a similar time to He Sees You When You're Sleeping, I imagine. I'm an actor, number one. That's what I love. And, you know, writing, I also love so much. You know, if I can write something and you know, get to showcase my acting as well, and, you know, get to do both, then I don't see why I wouldn't, kind of thing. And, you know, it's not all the time that that's going to happen. So I guess I'm just taking those opportunities while I can still get them.
Listen, guys, thank you so much for taking the time right before Christmas to be on the podcast.
Yeah, thanks for having us, Lauren.
Thanks so much, Lauren. And, you know, we've loved working with you. Oh, yeah, Merry Christmas, Lauren. Yeah, it's been so lovely chatting with you.
Thank you. You guys were brilliant. A super holiday thank you to Charlie Steeds and David Lennick for spreading their infectious humor and holiday spirit with us. This was actually a really difficult episode for me to edit because I am such a sucker for a British accent. Just don't tell my husband that. You can find out so much more about Charlie's films, including collaborations with David, on the website darktemple.co.uk. Don't forget to keep up with David and his film and writing projects on his Instagram, which is at David Lennick, L-E-N-I-K. Charlie is also at Charlie Steeds, S-T-E-E-D-S on Instagram. But as usual, you all know that this info will be in the show notes. A very Merry Christmas and holidays to you all, especially our supporters, Tom in Baltimore, James in Rhode Island, Tim in New Jersey, Nick in Texas, Anthony in Maryland, Chris in Texas, Aaron in Vermont, Sean in Illinois. Illinois, I can't believe I just said that. Oh my God, I've never said that before in my life. I don't know. Anyway, and of course, Ron, our newest supporter in snowy New Hampshire. So appreciative for you guys. I've got to finish baking my Christmas cookies. So between the dogs kind of distracting me here by being in my face, just don't forget to keep those bad Santas out and stay the hell out of the woods. Bye. Merry, merry.